one foot on the brake and one on the gas. There's too much traffic, and I can't pass. However, it's the Funk Zone Podcast with your host, Ted Mills.
Why, hello, 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 folks. Welcome to the Funk Zone Podcast. This is episode 55. I am your host, Ted Mills, not Sammy Hagar, because I like 55. This is the show where I interview artists and creative people and see what makes them tick and what makes them do what they do. I'm recording this in that sweet limbo spot between Christmas and New Year's. I hope you had a good holiday. Did Santa bring you something? Santa's not real. Did your loved ones bring you something? And as usual, thanks for listening to what is going to be our last show of 2015. Oh my goodness, our last show. It's been a good year. Thanks for always listening. My holiday was very mellow in a good way. I didn't have to leave town or any of that business. And let me just mention that I did get a very nice gift from my wife. It's a gin and tonic kit. You wouldn't think you'd need a kit to make a gin and tonic, but this one is filled with small containers of aromatics like licorice, juniper berry, pepper, hibiscus, rose petals, etc., etc., etc. Kumquats, even, I think. Perfect for making Spanish gin and tonics. Spanish ones come in what looks like a large wine glass. And so that's what I've been making recently. Not too many, of course, but that's what I've been making. Very nice. This week, our guest is Julie Joyce. Since 2008, she's been the curator of contemporary art over at the Santa Barbara Museum of Art. I met her in 2010 when I did an article on her Stranger Than Fiction exhibition, and we've met and chatted for various other articles ever since. Under her curation, she's brought the newest and most challenging of examples of contemporary art to the museum, including group shows like Labor and Wait and Totally 80s. And she's also introduced Santa Barbara to artists like Yinka Shinabare, Tony De Los Reyes, Michelle Stewart, and Charles Garabedian. Before Santa Barbara, she had curated at the Corcoran Gallery of Art in Washington, D.C., and at the Los Angeles County Museum of Art, a.k.a. LACMA. She writes on art, too, for places like Art Issues, and she has lectured and taught at Otis and Whittier College and many other institutions. Way too many for this introduction. The reason I wanted Julie on the show is that she is one of those people behind the scenes who is shaping the tastes of Santa Barbara by bringing in artists that most of us don't know or who rarely show here, like Peter Halley, who shows up through February of 2016. That's next year. That's also next week. And that's who we start talking about at the beginning of this interview. We also get into her life story, her theories of art, and my personal bugaboo, the turgid miasma of academic art writing. Okay. Julie Joyce doesn't have a personal site, by the way, not that I know of, but you can follow the museum at www.sbma.net, and they're on Twitter and Instagram as sbmuseart, S-B-M-U-S-E-A-R-T. Meanwhile, you can find me at tedmills.com for my writing, funkzonepodcast.com so you can sign up and subscribe to our email list, and you can find us on iTunes and subscribe, and also on Stitcher and subscribe. I'm also on Twitter as Ted Mills. That's right. Tweeting all about that business. And I swear, next episode, I'll have this Patreon page sorted out. It's taken longer than I thought. I need to come up with some really good prizes on all the various levels or little gifts or things like that. That's what I'm working on. So it will be cool. It will be done. It will be 2016. Okay, let's get started with our interview, recorded on November 19th, 2015. Whoa. And now ready for your ear hole download. So here we go. Julie Joyce, welcome to the Funk Zone Podcast.
Thank you, Ted. I am yes. So honored and excited to sit with you here today.
Yeah, and we are here in your office. I'm in the. Well, I don't want to say the bowels because we're not down
the
below.
Inner sanctum.
We're in the inner sanctum of the Santa Barbara
and I get
Museum
a window,
of Art,
which is really nice.
What are you looking out of? What do you look? Is it onto State Street? What is
yeah,
that?
Yeah, it looks out onto State Street, down onto the crosswalk in front of the store.
Oh, okay. Cool. Your current show that you've brought in is Peter Halley.
Yeah, Peter Halley. A New York artist who I've known about for a really long time. He's pretty famous and mostly shows in Europe, but doesn't really show so much in the United States for...
Or just California.
He had one solo show at a gallery, a commercial gallery, Michael Cohen Gallery. I think that was back in the 90s. Other than that, and he has shown in Palm Springs, the desert area, but this is his first solo museum show on the West Coast and, you know, perhaps even in a wider area.
Really?
The Western U.S. So.
Was that because of, is that him or is that his,
his
predilections?
You know, he's definitely known as a New York artist and it's always, depending on the institution, you know, people do show more local artists than people don't.
Mm.
His career has been largely in New York. And even in New York, though, I'd say, you know, most of that was sort of most active in the 80s and 90s. And more recently, his museum shows have been in Europe. Mm. His last major retrospective, which I have a book on my desk.
Is you got a stack of Peter Halley's
on
your
stack.
Desk.
I'm still trying to write the introduction for the catalog. But that we're going to produce and we're dropping in the installation shots, which is kind of unusual for us.
Mm.
But that show was in France. His major, major shows have been in France mostly.
Yeah. I thought he was like, when I first saw the art, I'm like, this guy's got to be from California.
Yeah.
Of the neon. But no.
Yeah, the colors are what you would think of as either California or perhaps even someplace like Vegas.
Yeah.
But, you know, that's also, too, the colors have been really intensifying over the years. They seem to be getting brighter and brighter. And
I don't know if they can get any brighter now. It hurt my eyes to go and look at it. I am not joking. Is that my glasses? Are my glasses?
Well, it's funny because I got a new pair of glasses right before the opening, and I was having a problem with my prescription, and so I finally took them back. But for a while, I thought it was just the paintings. It's easy to make that mistake. He is funny too because I almost feel like there's a glass half full and a glass half empty thing going on with the show, because of course the shapes, which are very basic, you can look at as empty or you know transparent or full, but also to the attitude. That people come in with. I like to think of the paintings as kind of mean. In fact, there's one painting that Peter painted just for the show that's the most recent piece in the exhibition. And it's a mean painting. And I said to Peter, we were looking at it for the first time because I wasn't quite sure what it was going to look like. I had received a sketch, but really wasn't sure. And when it went up on the wall, I said to him, I'm like, you know, that's kind of a mean painting, Peter. And he laughed and said, why, thank you. But, you know, a lot of people actually think that they're very bright and happy colors. So I'm not sure if that says more about the viewer than it does about the art.
Finally, they have some nice colors in the museum.
Yeah, but they do need quite a bit of space. So it was nice that we installed that in a rather minimal manner.
Yeah. Hold on a second. Whoop. Okay. What year is this for you as a contemporary curator?
Sorry about that.
That's all right.
I can't believe it myself, but I've actually just passed my 7-year mark.
Whoa.
In mid-September of 2015.
I feel like I just met you.
I know. Me too, Ted.
How many shows has that been? So, like, how many do you do a year?
Oh, my God. I don't know, but you're looking up on my bookshelf. And I've done some major shows. I mean, the first one I did was maybe not even 6 months after I started in fall of 2008. And that was a show for Yinka Shonibare. Mm-hmm. And it's funny, some people have been recently mentioning that show to me, which makes me think of kind of where I was at in the beginning. And I don't know, it seems like it's just kind of flown by. So Yinka Shonibare started with, did a couple major shows with catalogs, one for Charles Garabedian, the LA artist who was the subject of a recent show at LA Louvre Gallery in Venice, which may or may not still be up. And Getty Pacific Standard Time show, Ori Gerst, Labor and Wait. That was kind of like my big labor of an exhibition.
Yeah.
Pun intended.
Yeah.
Such a good one, but.
Have you got a sense of Santa Barbara now in terms of what people like? Not that you tailor to what people like, but do you get a.
I do, but of course, you know, I believe it or not, I do think about that. That's definitely a major part of the equation. I think I do. But at a certain point, you do just have to kind of do what you want to do and be a bit selfish, because sometimes those are the things that produce the most exciting results. But I think the audience up here has been really receptive. I remember when I first came in, I think one of the docents said to me, and our docents are fantastic. Mm-hmm. Like, they're really well read. They're very studious. They're very eager. Mm-hmm. And they are really our conduit to the audience directly. And one of them said, I don't know. Contemporary art, I'm kind of just really not into it or not. And I'm like, well, that's fine. You know, we'll get there. And I think that the audience here has been really receptive to that. To some of the painting shows that we've done from the permanent collection. Mm-hmm. I don't know. It's been a great experience for me. If there's a lot of biting criticism out there, I guess I haven't heard it, although I wouldn't be unwelcome mean of that. I like to hear feedback, whatever it is.
Because it's an educational thing. Being a curator is also you're trying to educate an audience about current trends, but you can't do too much didactic. Teaching.
I
guess.
Yeah, and I mean, I guess I would have taught if I felt that I was up to it. But there definitely is an educational aspect of what we do. Of course, our education department is really great at that. But you do. I mean, I think when I choose something to do, a show or an artist or a group of artists to work with, there has to be sort of like a, not just a win-win situation with several factors, including the audience. There has to be like a win-win-win-win component. And
that's a lot of wins.
It is a lot of wins. And that's what I'm sort of trying for, but other things that come into play, of course, the local community and how we can provide ports of entry for a show. But also, of course, and Larry Feinberg has been really good about this, our director, in terms of supporting the curators and telling them to basically do exhibitions that they dream of doing, things that they really want to do. But that also sort of comes into an aspect of being relevant on not just a local level through various ways and through various concepts and programs that relate to what's on view, but also a relevance in terms of what's happening in a larger regional aspect, like maybe down in LA, up in San Francisco. National and often international. I mean, there is a dialogue. The curators are sort of they have their feet in two realms. One, of course, is their museum, their community, what they do on a daily basis. But there's also a level out there that includes colleagues, critics, people interested in the arts from across the nation and internationally. And so you're sort of responding to all of those things. Some, of course, are on one end of the spectrum and some are on more closer to the other. but hopefully you want to maintain a relevance on all of those levels. Mm.
I feel like the show that was a direct expression of yourself. Well, they all are. But the one that really was the L.A. show.
What was it?
Made in L.A.?
Getty Pacific Standard Time show that also the Pasadena to Santa Barbara.
The one that was like the 80s one.
The 80s.
We were just talking about it.
The Left Coast.
Yeah.
Last year.
Yeah.
That was very much me.
Yeah, I kind of felt like that was your mixtape.
That's a really good way to put it, yeah. Actually. Yeah. Anyway, because I actually am at the very end of the baby boomer thing, so that's, it brings me back. Anyway,
so can we blame? I'll come back. Can we blame you? You're in the baby boomer. Can we blame you, or you're just on the cusp?
I'm just on the cusp of blame. Don't blame me, please.
Okay.
But yeah, that was kind of my mixtape. I mean, in a way, that was primarily, you know, we were also talking earlier about parameters, and you have certain parameters for certain exhibitions. And that particular one, because it was from the permanent collection, did have a certain parameter on it. And one of the things I decided to do in that slot over in the side galleries was to focus on recent acquisitions. Mm-hmm. But there were enough recent acquisitions in the Southern California, from artists in the Southern California region who had either studied, you know, worked in LA, still do, or had gone through there at some point, that I wanted to kind of focus on those. And it was a mixture of gifts from donors, from really great collections that we've been on the receiving end of for the last 7 years, and also some strategic purchases, some acquisitions. Mm. So that was a really fun show. It had a few artists that I had worked with in the past.
Yeah, that's what it felt like to me.
Yeah, it was really great. And it also had kind of this... you may have picked up on it. It was fun and colorful in some places, but it was also a little bit biting politically in some sections.
Well, you think of the 80s, especially if you think of art, you have to see 80s art in opposition to the Reagan era.
Yeah.
I don't think a lot of that art would have existed without... The salt on the art.
Yeah, that's the irony, isn't it?
Yeah. Right, yeah. Those were the days.
Yeah, those were the days. Sometimes I'm nostalgic for that era.
Things seem to be simpler. Yeah. But, okay, so L.A. comes to the picture, but that makes me want to go back and ask, like, where you come from? Because that's what I always want to say. Where are you from? Are you West Coast?
I am. I was born and raised in Altadena.
And
still actually am there on the weekends, mostly.
With the family?
My husband, two kitties.
Yeah.
Kitties.
Kitties. Yeah, not kitties. Meow. Kitties. Yeah.
No kids. I don't think I could do this, really. I just didn't feel like that was an option for me.
Yeah.
Or my husband, who's an artist, and he teaches at Art Center. Hmm. But yeah, from L.A., ended up out of undergrad working in an art gallery, a contemporary art gallery, because I became just kind of fascinated with... I was an art history major.
You're an art history major where?
At Loyola Marymount.
Oh, wow. Oh, yeah. So you grew up Catholic.
Grew up Catholic.
How are your parents, like, on the...
Uber Catholic.
Were they uber Catholic?
Yes.
Like...
priests on vacation and for dinner.
Many really?
Nights of the week, stuff like that.
Oh, really? Oh, fun conversations.
I was married in the Catholic Church.
You did? You have a Catholic wedding?
Yeah.
Yeah?
It was a short one because my husband wasn't Catholic.
So you just did
the best option, really. Okay.
Just do the important stuff, and then let's skip the reception.
Yeah, it's funny. I'm not practicing, any longer, but some of that has actually been useful in my career, actually. It comes up in funny ways. There are a couple artists whose work I'm attracted to, and then all of a sudden I find out that they were super religious and Catholic. And,
yeah. You got that vibe.
Yeah, including the guy who I did my thesis on. in graduate school, Paul Tech, who turned out to be extremely religious, even though completely conflicted because he was also gay, ended up dying from complications from AIDS in 1988. Really interesting work. And, you know, once I got into it, I realized, oh, my God, he was Catholic. Stuff like that happens.
Wow. So you grew up, Catholic schools, nuns?
Yep.
Yeah?
Nuns.
Do you have good ones or bad ones?
Well, I would like to say bad ones. I had really adversarial relationships with the two nuns that were teachers of mine in grade school.
Oh.
Like, really adversarial.
Yeah.
I think that does inform my practice, though.
It has informed your practice.
I find myself doing things because I just laugh to myself. I think, oh, that would be really kind of subversive. I know that, you know, you may look at the shows and say, oh, there's nothing subversive about that. But I do still have a little bit of that in me.
Oh, this will piss off Sister Wendy.
Yeah.
If she was around. Oh, I see. Was it just you or you have siblings?
Four siblings, two sisters, two brothers.
Wow.
Most of which are local.
Yeah.
Kind of San Luis Obispo and then on out to the desert.
Artists?
No.
You're the only one
who went into art history, but my mom and my grandmother were very creative. We did a lot of crafts and stuff at home. My grandmother did a lot of stitchery, abstract stitchery. Yeah.
What, like, just like follow where the needle goes?
Yeah, kind of pretty much. And like patchwork, you know, she actually did these wall pieces. I have one at home and she would sew up my, my little stuffed lamb. Like when it would go, it was so warm, she would stitch wings on it or cover its ears with leopard fur, stuff like that.
Yeah. Oh, there you go.
So I always kind of had that. And then when I went to art school, well, I didn't go to art school. I went to Pasadena City College after high school. And
so high school was Catholic, but Pasadena.
High school was Catholic Pasadena and I took art, but the art teacher just didn't. I don't know. I never got along with her. So, and then I took some art classes at City College and it just, a lot of the City College students were trying to get into places like Art Center in Pasadena. And so it got kind of competitive really quickly and I got kind of psyched out, but that's where I actually took my first art history class at Pasadena City College.
Yeah.
And then when I had transferred to Loyola Marymount and was doing really poorly at business math, which is why I went there.
What did you think you're going to be?
I don't know. I really don't know. Yeah. God, when you're so young, I don't even know how anybody does it anymore. I guess you have to know what you want to do. But
maybe that's a question that you ask these days, but like back then, like, yeah, you're just having a good time.
Yeah, exactly.
We need to know your 5-year plan.
Exactly.
When you're 5.
But in order to get my GPA up, I started taking art history classes because I remembered how much I loved it. And then I ended up just majoring in it. But really the thing that kind of turned me around is I was doing these art in LA classes and we ended up going to MoCA and it was when they had just gotten the Ponza collection. And I saw I know this is kind of this cliched story, but there was a room of Rothko's.
Oh, yeah.
And I was so, like, stunned. I went home and I was like, this is way too TMI. But I was so upset I couldn't stop crying. Huh. And a friend of mine at the time was like, well, maybe you should major in art history.
Why do you think you're crying?
I don't know. I think the work just deeply affected me and, you know, it led me to want to know more about him. And I had read the biography that Dore Ashton did. And I learned how depressed he was, you know. And if you've ever seen, I've seen maybe at least two of the major Rothko retrospectives, which they say can't even be done anymore because the work is too valuable and it will never, they always say it's never going to travel again. In fact, I saw one, the most recent one I saw was at the Kunsthalle in Hamburg, which was amazing because they paired a couple of those pieces with Caspar David Friedrich.
Mm-hmm.
And then in one room, they had like a couple Caspar David Friedrichs, a couple Rothkos, and then this amazingly beautiful black grand piano. Mm-hmm. I don't know what it was there for, but yeah. It was like, no, but as he goes on in life, the paintings get darker and darker and more minimal.
Mm-hmm.
And like, you can just sort of see the writing on the wall. So mm-hmm. I don't know. I just think it really came through for me. I don't know.
The mortality?
Yeah. Or just... Yeah, mortality or just depression, I guess. I don't know.
So that got you into art history or wanting to work in a gallery?
It got me into art history. So I majored in, I majored in art history and then took more of those Art in LA classes and became really fascinated with the gallery scene.
Mm.
And so when I got out of undergrad, I wanted to work in an art gallery.
Mm.
And this is when...
What year is this?
Oh, my God. Let's see, 1987.
Okay.
So I went to work for a gallery, a dealer. Her name is Dorothy Goldin. She's mm-hmm. still in the business, but she's now in New York. And she was sort of bringing down... She had been a part of a major gallery in San Francisco.
Mm-hmm.
And she was opening up her own space in L.A. in 1987. And it was in Santa Monica at 9th and Colorado, where a few other galleries were, including mm-hmm. At one point Blum-Hellman Gallery, which was a big deal, and Pence Gallery, another mm-hmm. Bay Area person, and a couple others, Roy Boyd Gallery down the street. He was a Chicago sort of gallery that had come out to LA. It was an interesting time. A lot of the galleries were showing New York artists, mm-hmm. and that's probably where I started reading, or when I started reading about Peter Halley more. And it was just a great place to kind of get my feet wet, and a really fantastic place if you wanted to know anybody in the art world, because mm-hmm. everybody comes through the galleries.
Mm.
The curators, the artists, the collectors, the other dealers, the writers.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think I was also maybe talking about criticism in those days, and it was really a much more active scene, at least in LA.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you had an art forum editor on the West Coast, and you had, I know, and then you had... all these other magazines, eventually Art Issues, which I ended up writing for, mm-hmm. which was a great magazine. Arts was there, and that's where actually, coincidentally, Peter Halley first started publishing his essays.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a really great time, actually.
How'd you get your first job
in
the gallery? How'd you blag your way into that?
That's an interesting question. So... You know, I tell young people this now and they look at me like I'm insane, but I did a lot of things for free,
mm-hmm.
you know, like interned here and there. Like I did an internship at LACMA when I was an undergrad. But I just sort of, yeah, I think I just tried to work my way in, and I found a couple people who were really sympathetic, and mm-hmm. I was pretty driven. I said, this is what I want to do.
Mm-hmm.
You know, how do I do this? And I interviewed a bunch of people, and finally somebody sort of recommended me to a couple people who were looking for gallery assistants. And I don't know why Dorothy hired me, but it was great.
Yeah. Did the job live up to what you thought you'd be doing?
I didn't really have a lot of expectations. All I knew is that I kind of had this odd idea that rather than work with artists who were dead, or, you know, as an art historian, you know, you sit there and you were looking at two slides up on the carousel.
Yeah.
Remember that?
Yeah.
And all I thought was, wow, it's so much more exciting to me to actually be a part of what might be history.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I didn't think that what I was doing was, you know, the bomb or anything, but it was just really, really kind of great that way. It kind of fascinated me that you could kind of make these environments happen. It did, the world was so strange to me. Mm-hmm. I just kind of had to like figure, you know, try to figure it out. Mm. And it was great. I mean, there's nothing like it because you really kind of have to turn around on a dime, you know, mm-hmm. that it goes much faster. You decide to do a show in much less time than you do in a museum, which I'm still sometimes trying to get used to. Mm-hmm. But it was pretty cool. I was able to work with people like Nam June Paik,
mm-hmm.
who we talked about yeah. earlier.
Yeah.
And he was fantastic. I was just, you know, you meet somebody like that and you're just like completely in awe. Christo and Jean-Claude came through. You know, other famous artists would come through, and it was just, I don't know, it was just really cool. I, you know, being able to be part of something and make these environments happen. Like, it's funny, interestingly enough, I was just thinking about Nam June Paik and the TV clock that the museum mm-hmm. owns, mm-hmm. which is one of our fantastic pieces in as a part of the permanent collection. We actually showed that at Dorothy Goulding's gallery
mm-hmm.
back in the, must have been late 80s or early 90s.
Wow. And yeah. It turned up here.
Huh. I probably typed up the invoice.
Were you collecting art yourself? Like in your apartment? Did you have,
you know, it's so funny. Art up on the walls? I was super young and I couldn't really, the gallery job didn't really pay much. So I was kind of living at home for mm-hmm. a while. And then I met my now husband of almost 25 years, wow. Adam Ross, who coincidentally went to school up here at UCSB.
Really?
For undergrad and grad. And we met because Randy Summer, who was our third director at Dorothy's, Randy was, I think, Adam's TA at UCSB. And so Randy brought him in to show at the gallery. And we just sort of met that way and struck up a friendship and eventually got married.
Mm. So is this your roundabout way of saying the art I have on the walls is my husband's?
Oh, yes. Right. I needed to answer your question. we were just really poor. Maybe that's what I was sort of getting at, is that we never really had... And I know a lot of people... You don't have to be rich to form a collection.
Yeah, yeah.
Certainly. But... We always had like many more pressing things, like the bills to pay, which sometimes still kind of, you know, we collect a little bit, but our collection actually is more through trades that he makes with other artists.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is really cool because then you have, you know, your friends up and We just haven't had that kind of... I think every time we make a little extra income, it goes toward fixing our house up or something.
Oh, that's the art project.
Yeah, but we've certainly helped a lot of people collect, you know, and a lot of our... We've made a lot of good friends, and some of our past friends end up collecting. So, yeah, that's kind of the downside of it, because you think of openings that... you've been to back in the late 80s and seen a particular thing that is now selling for a ton of money.
You could have had it for $25.
I know. And it's like, it's sort of like the curse of being on the other end.
Do you feel like over the years then that you've got you've had a good eye of what would go on to be an important artist?
That's a good question. I really wish I had kept track of it in some quantifiable way, because and if you don't buy, I guess you just don't have any record of it. It's funny, I think some things, you know, some things, if I had sort of picked them out in the late 80s, would have probably appreciated in value, but probably a lot of things wouldn't. I think that the odds just really aren't that good, even for people who know what they're doing.
Yeah.
So I always, of course, you know, being on the sales end of it, I kind of was like, well, don't buy it unless you really love it.
Yeah.
And I mean, that's a really good rule, because you could, you know, I know things are very crazy right now with the art market, but you could really be stuck with it. Not, you know, not everything makes a ton of money, and I'm not so sure I advocate collecting for those reasons anyway.
Yeah. So are we in the middle of an art bubble?
it would appear that way. Yeah. I think yes.
Yeah.
But you know, it's kind of like, I mean, what goes up does come down.
Yeah.
I mean, we've learned that several times through the real estate bubble, mm-hmm. and it's happened in the art world. It seems to happen. What it happened in 1990 for mm-hmm. sure, and it happened before that and after that. Mm.
So you saw that happening in the 90s, like early 90s. Mm-hmm. Where were you when you saw that happening, and what was an example of watching it happen? Well, let's see.
Was that when, I think it was the evening we invaded Kuwait or something.
Yeah.
And we were at an opening at Gagosian Gallery.
Uh-huh.
And it was like, I don't know. I just remember sort of looking around and going, okay, this is happening.
Yeah.
But then, you know, it all came back, I guess. I think the problem now is that I just know of so many, it kind of, for me, parallels what's happened with the economy. Mm-hmm. You know, the whole percent thing.
The one percenters.
The 1%.
Yeah.
Whereas a lot of people in the art world follow the same parallel. Like many, you know, there are artists and collectors and dealers, what have you, that got that much wealthier. But there seems to be a much greater percentage of artists in particular who've kind of fallen by the wayside. And even the gallery system, you know, there are a lot of mid-tier galleries who mm-hmm. maybe don't sell things, don't have franchises around the world.
Yeah.
And don't sell things for over $100,000 that are really struggling. Many of which have closed.
Yeah.
And a lot of mid-career artists, you know, who just are, you know, struggling mm-hmm. financially. A lot of them have other jobs, day jobs, and those people are probably the more fortunate ones.
Mm. You've watched artists' careers take off then, and the ones who have been successful. Obviously, there's an element of luck to it. And being talent plus opportunity, right?
Mm-hmm.
But in your opinion, the ones who have taken off and become successful, why did that happen? Was it a one collector who did it? Why does that happen to certain people and not to others?
You know, it's a good question. I think it is a combination of things, and I don't think there's a formula.
Hmm.
I do see that with what's been happening currently with, say, maybe not necessarily locally, but on an international scale, or say out of a place like New York, for instance, there are some artists who are kind of set up for it in terms of having the quantities available
mm-hmm.
for people like the Francois Pinots of the world and their golf buddies to kind of buy into. It's kind of like this, it almost seems like collusory activity,
mm-hmm.
you know, and they're playing it much like you would possibly play the market, although there doesn't seem to be anything about insider trading in the art world that makes it illegal.
No, not yet.
I mean, some people say, oh, it's the last regulated business, and other people would argue with you, oh, it's regulated, you know.
Yeah.
But there are a lot of things that happen behind closed doors and a lot of shenanigans that come out in lawsuits here and there that mm-hmm. kind of give indications about some of the things that are happening. Granted, that's not everything.
Mm.
But I think, you know, I think one of the things that has become apparent is that an artist really has to have a high production volume
mm-hmm.
one way or another.
You got to be ready for when you take off.
Ready for people to, quote unquote, invest, which,
yeah,
you know, I don't know. Granted, I kind of don't know what I'm talking about because I try not to. As a curator, you're supposed to be aware of these things
yeah.
and you watch the auctions, what's happening, because you want to be aware of opportunities.
Mm-hmm.
when they become available for the permanent collection, and mm-hmm. also for the donors to museum who ask you questions mm-hmm. and things. But at the same time, you kind of have to divorce yourself of the market because it really has become its own real entity. Mm-hmm. I kind of feel like there are various art worlds. There's not just one. Mm-hmm. There are these parallel universes mm-hmm. of art worlds. Yeah, yeah. Say you're at an opening and you don't know it in your hometown, you don't know anybody there. You know, that's an instance of that.
Yeah.
And the market's sort of one of those things. It's kind of its own animal.
Hmm.
And I feel like I have no idea what's going on.
Well, you're a part of that into the gallery world, but the museum world is very different. It takes you out of that a little bit. It's not like I can go shopping here if I had $1 million. But
it astounds me that, you know, in the United States, in the past, there have been these boundaries established, or there's supposed to be these boundaries between, you know, the nonprofit sector, the museum curators, and the market. But I do see a lot of curators who don't really seem to respect those boundaries as much. And they tend to, it just always amazes me when you see an artist who, like for instance, Josh Smith, I don't understand why that work is so expensive, and it also has this sort of self-ridiculing manner to it. And I guess that makes me, I don't know, conservative in some way, but here's an artist who makes, you know, a lot of money for his paintings, and at the same time was being bought up by a lot of these big sort of hedge fund type of collectors. And then, you know, you go to the Venice Biennale and you see that work in the Venice Biennale and you're like, what? Did you really have to put that work in? Like, come on.
Yeah.
But I'm sure people look at my shows and say the same thing. So who am I?
Do you think Damien Hirst is the one guy who's like really knows the world that he's in?
I think he's done. I always have to admire artists who are able to take advantage of the market. Mm-hmm. And I think he has been one. I think Wim Delvoye is another, and I included him in Labor and Weight specifically for mm-hmm. that reason, because mm-hmm. I think he's very smart. He's very critical of what he calls the corruptocracy. And
mm-hmm.
But at the same time, he utilizes quite brilliantly these capitalist strategies. So I actually kind of, I think Damien Hirst certainly knows what he's doing. And I think, yeah, sure, why not?
Expert trolling, as they would call it.
No, I think he's quite smart.
Yeah.
I like some of the work. I don't like all of it. But I don't know. I don't mind it in that regard. It just, I don't know, sometimes it just gets to be too much, you know, too completely douchey.
When, you know, you had a career of meeting artists, do you feel that is helped your appreciation of art, or do you think sometimes it's kind of damaged it in a bit because it's taken away a little bit of mystery? Not because, oh, I met someone and they were mean and so to your art, but
that has happened.
Well, I'm sure that's happened too. But sometimes the thing about when you meet a work of art, there's a mystery to it.
Yeah.
And that I would feel would go away if you knew everybody.
That happens. That definitely happens. In fact, it even happens sometimes, like when I've seen retrospective shows.
Mm-hmm.
You know, artists, there's this sort of myth of the curse if you do a retrospective show as an artist.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you don't want to call it a retrospective because it's like a death sentence or something.
Yeah, it's your epitaph.
But sometimes I've admired an artist's work and then I see the retrospective and I'm like, ooh, not so much, you know?
Yeah.
That happens sometimes. And then there was one case in particular where I had admired this work by an artist and I finally met him and he was such an incredible ass, like in the worst way. And it really did affect my impression of the work.
Yeah.
It does happen. I mean, you know, there are some artists, though, where, like, you know, I don't know, in my opinion, like, could do no wrong.
Mm-hmm.
You know, whether that person's a jerk or not, or whether, you know.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of like the Woody Allen thing, right? Like,
yeah. Yeah. Well, you take your pick, yeah.
Yeah, it's like, yeah, or, you know, I don't know.
Or there's also artists who are very down-to-earth, but then do not make down-to-earth art, and you have no idea. Like, I can't parse the person that I know
with yeah.
the work that they do.
Right.
It's like, it's made by somebody else.
Yeah.
So that mystery still remains.
Yeah, I think so. And I think, yeah, it's funny. Certain artists do have very guarded ways about them.
Mm.
And artists, to a certain degree, do have to protect themselves sometimes, you know, from, like, showing up at an art fair and damaging their... their already poor impression of the art world.
Yeah, yeah. Well, everything's going to art fairs. Like, we talked about that once when we did a...
the art fair thing.
Yeah.
It's really depressing for me.
Is it still on the ascendance? Or is it...
You know,
do you think we've
there's
hit a plateau?
Been this term that's being bandied about... I may have heard it maybe 6 months ago, the notion of art fair fatigue.
Well, that's good.
I think it is good because yeah. I know I certainly have it. In fact, I've been to Miami Art mm-hmm. Basel a couple times, but it's really hard for me to go. It's just, I don't know, part of it's just sort of maybe an old fashioned thing that I feel like I did so much to get where I am.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I worked, I can't even tell you how many jobs I did for free, writing jobs, mm-hmm. you know, volunteer work, internships. It wasn't easy, you know, it was really, was not easy. And I don't fit there's an antiquated model of someone being from a wealthy family, you know, that,
yeah,
you know, you go into art history and then you know you work for a gallery, and I wasn't one of those or mm-hmm. anything. So and then you show up at a fair like that, and it's like Disneyland. There's a ticket, a B ticket, a C ticket,
yeah,
an E ticket,
yeah,
whatever. I don't even remember.
Screaming children
what.
And long lines and
overpriced
food.
Just like, you know, in terms of what you can get into and what you can't get into. And
yeah.
that just, I don't need to feel insulted that way.
Mm.
Because, you know, it's the same thing too, where I feel like, you know, it's great that art is getting more attention among the celebrity crowd, but I really resent celebrities
mm-hmm.
calling themselves artists. I really don't like that James Franco thing at all. For instance, I just think you stay over there.
Mm-hmm.
You can make a lot of money over there. Do you really have to come over on this side?
Yeah, yeah.
And I know you're probably going to get some mean letters about that. But
I don't know. Well, he was going to be our guest on the show next week, but we'll have to cancel that. You have, I just looked up in your shelf because I was thinking about writing, and you have mm-hmm. one of my favorite writers up there, Dave Hickey.
Oh, yeah.
Right. And more than anybody else, he writes on art in a way I think is very accessible, but can also talk about very complicated issues. And
yeah.
I was going to ask questions about art writing.
Uh-huh.
Because it does seem that these days, if you're an artist, you also have to walk the walk in terms of art writing, and I can't stand art writing. Right? So I want to know where you are on that, because you've probably had to write a few things.
I have, yeah. Well, thanks for asking. It's funny that you mentioned Dave Hickey, because one of the things I did, and I did get paid for this. It was minimal, though, as you know. It was I did reviews for Art Issues magazine for a while. I think it was the early 90s that I started. Actually, I got that gig through Michael Darling, who used to be here at UCSB and who's now the chief curator at the MCA in Chicago. He helped me start writing for Art Issues because he was writing. And at the time, in the early 90s, there was kind of this very regional type of spat in the art world between what people were sort of calling neo-conceptualism and beauty, which was the Dave Hickey model, because Dave Hickey wrote quite a bit for that magazine, as did his wife, Libby Lumpkin, who's also a really great writer. And Gary Kornblau was the editor. And it's very interesting because I always felt like I was kind of straddling. I wanted to be fair to both. It was a local thing, you know, how this happens. I'm sure, you know, I know it happens here a little bit in other regards too.
But in terms of writing, honestly, about local artists?
Writing or other things, you know, like showing, I don't know. There's also, of course, now the whole like street art thing versus fine art or whatever you want to call it. But I really always loved his writing, and I was attracted to in grad school. When I went to grad school at USC, my advisor was Susan Larson, who had a very humanist approach. And I know that's seen as completely old-fashioned, or at least it has been seen as old-fashioned in the art world.
We mean art as good for you.
Art is good for you, but also when you're writing about an artist, having kind of like more of a biographical or like a human interest approach rather than like an interest in the artist and her life rather than...
Like this podcast.
Yeah.
It's like this very podcast. I guess this is the humanist podcast.
Yes, I won't pontificate about philosophical post-structuralist theory. Or anything like that, which it can be useful, of course. But I tend to like things that are more approachable. I never saw myself as strictly academic in that regard. And I know I appreciate writing that you can understand.
Yes.
And, you know, I mean, that doesn't put you to sleep at night. Yeah. So I'm
Can you read that stuff, though? The academic writing? Do you actually, like, read and go, I know you have to, but do you...
In grad school.
Yeah, but do you ever stop and go, what the...
Well, yeah, I do, but I have... I got to say, I have to admit, I have very little patience for it.
Okay.
And I think as I get older, you know, you're younger than me, I'm sure, but... You just kind of lose patience for the kind of stuff that you just don't have patience for. I can certainly dive into it. I mean, of course, going back to our friend, Mr. Peter Halley, you know, there's a lot of, even his own writing is informed by theoretical principles, but I do find that it's still interesting. And I think there's a way to do both.
Yeah.
And of course, there's a lot of critics who have written about Peter Halley's, you know, anyone, you can find writing that's on both ends of the spectrum, but I tend to like things that are conceptually interesting and also interesting to read at the same time. Which I guess kind of goes also back to my, one of the principles I sort of try to follow in presenting or representing art and artists is a healthy balance between what, and I'll impress you with some theoretical knowledge here.
Okay.
Steven Greenblatt wrote an essay that I read as a grad student. And I don't know if this is the title of the piece, but it's his concept of resonance and wonder, like a piece of art. I think he's a proponent that a piece should have that resonance and wonder. And so that's been one of my, weather vanes in terms of, you know, things that I like and I tend to want to present. I want it to have some visceral attraction. You know, I want it to be engaging for people to kind of stop in their tracks and look at it. But I also want the other side. I want there to be ports of entry, if you will, or subject matter outside of the gallery that people can actually connect to and find resonance in. I don't know.
Like for the Peter Halley, you have to, it helps that you to know that he has been working on the prison and the conduits.
Yeah, the prison cells.
Prison cells and conduits. Yeah. Like, so you need that. You need to know that.
I think so. It's very helpful to know.
Yeah. Otherwise, but you know, when I first saw, I didn't know that. I thought that I said to myself, "This looks like circuitry," which was pretty close.
Right? Yeah, but I'm interested in that stuff. I don't know about you. Like that to me is like, oh, that's cool. It looks like something kind of futuristic.
And it looks like air ducts. The slats look like air ducts. So,
or like, you know. I mean, what I like to think about in terms of that show, and I don't know, Peter may not agree with me. So sorry, Peter, if you hear this in advance. You know, when he came out, when he started working in the 80s, and this isn't such a far stretch. You know, he's well-read in everything from, you know, speaking of post-structuralist French theorists.
That's, yes.
You know, he's a big advocate of Baudrillard and Michel Foucault.
Mm-hmm.
And Foucault's notion of a carceral society in particular. But he also has been linked with science fiction. And I'm a huge fan of science fiction. And
hard sci-fi or fantasy sci-fi?
More like Neuromancer beyond. So specifically, and speaking of which, you know, William Gibson, of course, came out with this term, cyberspace, before we even knew what it was.
Yeah.
And I kind of think of Peter Halley's paintings in the same way. Mm. Like for me, he kind of identified this thing that, really, I didn't know what it was, but I thought, wow, that's really kind of great.
Mm-hmm.
I just get that feeling like when I'm reading a good, like William Gibson book or something that I get when I look at a Peter Halley painting, because in a way, by identifying these three simple icons in his work and providing a metaphor or sort of a model in which to interpret his own work, he kind of, for me, identified something that continues to maintain relevance even today. And so, say, for instance, you know, those paintings in the 80s.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know, I'm not a computer tech person.
But, well, here comes the the art blaze. And they're passing. Sorry.
Okay. Continue. So, like, I don't know much about computers, but for me, like I saw a Peter Halley painting and I sort of, then I saw a computer chipboard, you know, they kind of have this way of predicting things. I think.
Yeah. Yeah. But art as prediction.
Yeah. Art is prediction. Art is, sort of, artists as talisman or something
Seers,
like that. Right. Seers.
Yeah. Seers. The name of the show is Funk Zone Podcast. So let's talk about the Funk Zone and the scene in Santa Barbara. I also do understand that you don't always get time to go out and see a lot of stuff.
I try. You know, I really do try because I sort of split my time between here and L.A. County.
Yeah.
There are so many galleries now in Los Angeles that most Fridays and Saturdays I'm sort of in LA looking around. But I do get around up here, and I do have made studio visits with some of Santa Barbara's finest,
mm-hmm.
and then some, you know, some younger people as well. I don't, but like the events on the weekends I just don't get to, but sometimes that's okay because it's so much better to see the art when you can see it without the opening.
Yeah.
And
yeah. Cause I'll go to an opening at certain places and they'll say, how is the art? I'm like, I couldn't see it.
Exactly.
Too many people.
Right.
So you go back and check it out. So
yeah, definitely. I love what's been going on at, we were talking about the Atkinson Gallery in particular. I really miss that.
Yeah.
We
have Sullivan Goss across the street.
Yeah, I go over there.
But who are the contemporary artists in town that you're liking?
That I'm liking?
Yeah.
It's sort of a range. I really like what Nathan Hayden's doing.
Mm-hmm.
I have yet to sort of keep abreast of what he's been up to lately. I love the fact that he also dances in his studio. I think about that all the time. I would love to like be able to dance while I work.
Mm.
But beyond that, I was sort of an early advocate of Eric Belt's, and mm-hmm. we acquired one of his drawings
mm-hmm.
Called Drunk Jesus, which mm-hmm. I really love. And I included that in a small show called Stranger Than Fiction.
Oh, yeah. I remember that.
I really like... God, I really love that show that Keith Puccinelli and Dane Goodman did mm-hmm. up at Westmont.
Mm-hmm.
I thought that was pretty fantastic. There are definitely other people. I mean, I think when I... Growing up in L.A. in the art world, I knew... I definitely kept an eye open for Santa Barbara artists, and people that I was probably most aware of are people like Joan Tanner,
mm-hmm.
Hank Pitcher,
mm-hmm.
Dan Connolly, Richard Ross, people like that. And so I do keep in touch with them through various channels.
Mm.
I talk to Dane Goodman a lot. I think he's just... I don't know, him being a gallery director at the Atkinson.
Yeah. What's he doing now?
He had that big, he retired from SBCC.
Yeah.
He
had the show.
Had the show and just working away in his studio. And Marie Sheff, who is also a really wonderful artist, they're just, and she's still teaching at Westmont. And I don't know, there's so much talent in town.
Mm. Do you have the power to acquire pieces?
Yeah. I don't know what's going to happen with the forthcoming renovation. We probably have to kind of put a hold on that for a while.
Mm-hmm.
But I have made it a point to collect, some local work by some local artists along with other people,
mm-hmm.
Whether through gift or purchase. And we have made at least a few purchases of local artists. No, I think it's really important. I know that, we certainly don't do as much as many of the other spaces in town do with local art. I have, we have done a few things with the, the Left Coast show. We had, Summer Roman Sheffield,
mm-hmm.
In that exhibition. We had Robert Wexler, who came out of UCSB and is more down in Glendale, LA mm-hmm. these days, but has an affiliation with Santa Barbara. So I do, whenever the focus is West Coast, I do always attempt to include an element of Santa Barbara,
mm-hmm.
whether it's historic or current.
Mm.
Yeah.
Last question, we shall wrap it up. Which is just your daily routine as a curator. Do you have an average day, or is there sort of like a percentage devoted to certain things that more than others?
Yeah, because I'm also helping to supervise our photography department right now. A lot of administrative stuff lately, but. I'd say my perfect day would be...
Yeah, okay. We'll do that.
Going to a studio visit or two. Mm-hmm. having a lunch meeting with somebody else, whether it's a collector, donor, writer, mm-hmm. whatever, yeah. which I often do, which is great. And maybe coming back and walking somebody through a show at the museum. It doesn't often happen like that. But
Less paperwork is the ideal thing.
Less emails. God, I don't know about you, but I'm inundated with email. It's really kind of sad. And also, I would love to... Actually, I should back up. I would love to begin the day by doing some quiet writing, which I don't get enough time to do. Because I really do enjoy it, but I don't... It's those things, like the studio visits, the writing, in particular, that you don't get to do as much as you would like to.
Mm-hmm.
But... and there's also a lot of work for development purposes. A lot of what I do is based on trying to find support for the programs that we're doing. Mm-hmm. You know, and that's every curator has to do a lot of that.
Yeah.
Whether it's for, you know, acquiring artworks or funding for exhibitions or just general, you know, making people happy.
All right.
Because we want happy people.
The Peter Halley is going to go up through what time? What date?
That is a good question.
It's next year, though. Yeah.
Well, it's up through next year. Sometime in February.
Oh, look, it's your desktop.
Yes, that's right.
Oh, that's got to hurt. Sorry, Peter.
We'll go to the website. Yeah, the Peter Halley is up
We have this new website,
by the way.
We are literally going to the website and looking.
It's up through February 21st, 2016.
Okay, there you go. So, not that I know exactly what day this will appear, but I can safely say that it will probably still be up. Come to the Santa Barbara Museum of Art. Check it out. And there's other stuff coming up. Who knows?
Yeah.
Who knows what's coming up?
If I might mention, too, the Caetano Ferrer exhibition is one of my favorite exhibitions we've ever done. Yeah. And that's up through March
13th. All right. All the fun of the casino floor, none of the jackpot machines.
No gambling.
No gambling. And only if you're a collector in your art world.
Thank you so much, Chad.
Thank you.
This has been great.
I had a good time. There you have it, folks. Julie Joyce, recorded in her office, apparently next to a Harley Davidson factory a few times. I thought, really? Really, guys? Anyway, I hope you enjoyed that chat. We got into it there. And make sure you check out the Peter Halley exhibit, which we talked about, which is up. It will make your eyes hurt in all the good ways. You can follow me at Ted Mills at Twitter, at tedmills.com for my writing, Function Podcast, to subscribe, or you can subscribe over at iTunes, and we're going to be on Stitcher, and hopefully when Google sorts things out on there, Google Play or Google Music or whatever they're going to call it, many ways to continue listening to this show. Oh my goodness, so this is the last show of 2015. I don't know if you're listening to it as the clock ticks up towards the end of the year, but we'll see you in 2016. I hope 2016 is going to be awesome for everybody, for all of us. So I'm going to let the last word go, as usual, to my friend Joseph Campbell from Second Grade, not the one who wrote Power of Myth, but the man who said this.
And now for a big goodbye. See you soon. We'll make some more tapes later on. Bye. We might make some more tapes later on. Bye. We might make more tapes later on. Yeah. See you soon. Bye.